Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by John Bryce of USA Today and Pete Sampson of The Athletic. And guys, before we delve into about a dozen camp-related questions, there's more off-the-field news from the courts, this time in Louisiana. Former Notre Dame defensive lineman Junior Tui Halamaka is among about three handfuls of players granted a temporary restraining order Wednesday to return to college for a final season by a Louisiana judge. Unlike the rest of the guys, the class of 2022 included in the lawsuit, Tui Halamaka was never in the NFL camp. He had an injury, I guess, on pro day, knocked him out of NFL minicamp. So, JB, I want to throw it to you fast on this. What is this TRO? How has it changed for the players separate, I guess, from the ability to transfer, or is that the main change?
No, I have some notes on it that I'll be better off reading. But what it does is it continues to mean the NCAA not only needs to win its case to get a stay granted against the U.S. District Court judge in Colorado, Caroline Weems, I think is her name. Charlotte Sweeney, sorry. And so they need that one first and foremost, because if they get their stay granted there, they can start then trying to have more success at the state court level, which they did have already in Ohio. If you'll remember, Ohio immediately had a judge grant a bunch of eligibility, a bunch of student athletes eligibility from that 22 class, a number of basketball players among them. And the NCAA sought a stay in that court order and was granted that stay. And so now, again, the big thing is what happens in the Colorado court. If the NCAA is successful there, it can try to challenge then, or at least get stays granted at the state court level. If the NCAA is unsuccessful with the U.S. District Court in Colorado, then a lot of these state rulings, and my understanding is that a lot of these state rulings then don't matter because the federal ruling will supersede that. So the best way I know to put it, from somebody who's works in that space, texted me yesterday, the NCAA can still fight an injunction by appealing and asking another court to stay its order. Just like I said, it happened in Ohio. Right now, these players are still covered by the national Colorado case for their eligibility, unless that Colorado case is also stayed. So right now, the states of California, New York, Tennessee, Georgia, Texas, Colorado, Oklahoma, and now Louisiana have the temporary restraining order / injunction protection. Kentucky and South Carolina, I think, also are states that have cases in their court system awaiting a ruling. So the biggest thing overall is that 10th U.S. District Court ruling in Colorado. And the NCAA, again, like, it's as simple as if the NCAA wins that, even with a stay, then it can fight some of these others and try to keep the policy as it is that doesn't grant the eligibility to those class of 22 student athletes. If it's unsuccessful in Colorado, then a lot of these state orders just simply don't matter.
Not sure it'll matter for Notre Dame. I know they're apprehensive, Pete, about the possibility of legislation after the fact allowing Tui Halamaka, he was the only option, allowing Tui Halamaka to play in a game and then be burned by that later. Seems like it'd be tough to enforce that, like retroactively for all the players that play, that those games are somehow in jeopardy. But I guess we're being careful.
On top of that, I think it would be tough for Junior Tui Halamaka to be like, all right, I'm ready to play. Yeah. I think, what's the point of spring practice, summer workouts, and fall camp if you can just skip them and then be ready to go? Would he help Notre Dame in some small way? Yeah, I'm sure that he would, especially maybe more in November and December, which he has already helped Notre Dame in December or early January once. So I think Indiana's much bigger beneficiary of this than Notre Dame would be. And it is, I think, even looking at the sort of the documentation from Louisiana, this isn't like 275 players.
Right.
This is a very narrow slice of football players who, would suddenly be eligible. But it's interesting. I'm skeptical that it would make a appreciable difference to Notre Dame if it went through and suddenly you had two number 44s on the defensive line.
Yeah, really, really good points there. I'll add to it a little bit. The Louisiana thing is a little more interesting because it specifically creates a pathway for players who have been in professional camps, be it NFL camps or presumably NBA camps, to have a pathway back. As you guys have alluded to, Notre Dame has discussed the potential return of JT and sits at 104 on its roster now. So it has a spot, a fully scholarship spot left. And obviously, if they made that decision and the court orders stayed as they are now and Notre Dame elected to do that, then it wouldn't be able to bring him back at a very negligible cost beyond a scholarship or whatever. What my understanding is, he just barely moved out of the South Bend area late in the summer. Like he only maybe moved to like Arizona or somewhere really right as at the same time that Notre Dame was starting preseason camp and had not transitioned yet full-time into the business world, had still been staying in shape and working out in case he got the call to report to an NFL camp as a UDFA. And so I do find that component of it interesting. It has been discussed by them. They certainly believe that he would be an asset in the locker room, a natural leader that they saw from him in recent years. But there was definitely a cost-benefit analysis that they were weighing there that had to do more with not really the dollars of the cost, so to speak, but how does it impact the development of a couple of young studs that they believe they have who are going to be stars?
Yeah, I think the one way of looking at it, and we all like Tui Halamaka, he would obviously help the team. If this was Jadarian Price, you're not having the conversation.
Yeah.
It's over. And that's
you can pull him out of Seattle Seahawks camp anytime.
Here's one scenario I would point out. If this and apparently the Colorado court order could come as soon as today, tomorrow, like the NCAA has asked for it with great haste. Obviously, the plaintiffs want it with great haste as well to try and get a better handle on what their futures are and if they're going to have a federally protected path. But if Junior goes on and Notre Dame doesn't open that door, but this Colorado order is upheld and suddenly the class of 2022, all those people are eligible and maybe more than have filed lawsuits now decide, hey, actually, I do have it in me to play one more. Would there be a veteran quarterback out there that could be a fit on the Notre Dame roster for a backup role? That's one thing I would just, it's highly, highly unlikely, but that's one scenario that's worth at least examining.
Pete Sampson, you should ask Marcus Freeman that tomorrow with one of your two questions when we are discussing. also off the field, but very much affecting Notre Dame fans. And NBC announces its announcing team, Dan Hicks, season 3, Jason Garrett, season 5. And new addition to the sideline, Notre Dame alum, Caroline Pineda. I don't want to mess this up, Pete, but you did talk to Caroline recently for your podcast. So I'll go ahead. And
yeah.
If it was a mistake, I'm sorry, because we're too far in to cut the mic.
Yeah, that on the Independent with Matt Fortuna, we had her on this morning. I think that podcast will be up later today. But
I hope it's after this one, so I scooped it right there.
Yeah. Maybe people will be listening on different devices at the same time. Very confusing. Yeah, 2022 grad. She's been involved in NBC production. I think her second half of her sophomore year, junior, senior year, sort of helping out Catherine Tapper on the sidelines. She'd done Big East basketball, Big Ten football, some MLB stuff, some WNBA stuff, and, you know, Pro Day, Blue and Gold game as well. So not exactly, I think, a new face around Notre Dame if you've been watching, and certainly not around NBC either. But, yeah, she's like, you can listen to our conversation on the pod. She sort of got into, like, how she got into this. And I asked her, like, you're the last person who's going to talk to Marcus Freeman before kickoff at Wisconsin. What do you want to ask? So she's, yeah, I think she is good at her job, and I got to know her a little bit as a student. So, yeah, props to Caroline for moving up the NBC ladder.
AP Top 25 came out right after our last podcast on Monday. Scheduled that way, not a jinx this time. Notre Dame comes in at number 4, I think, because it doesn't matter. But I did want to get into you guys a little bit. Pete, I know you have some top 25 notes from Ralph Russo. And JB, I want to start with JB because this is an interesting one. JB has a note regarding Notre Dame's new in-state rival and their AP ranking and schedule.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, among those top 6 teams, maybe even the teams in the top 10, Indiana is considered by ESPN to have the number 33 strength of schedule, which I think I saw was lowest among those. So despite the fact that Indiana has games against Michigan, Ohio State, and USC, it is seen by the computer metrics as being a schedule softer than that of Notre Dame's, even though the Notre Dame chorus about its schedule is already in peak form about it not being tough enough. But, you know, Notre Dame, as it does every year, seemingly every year, opens away from home, closes away from home, and does not have an FCS foe on its docket. There are many, many teams in the top 10. I haven't done the research like I did last year, but many, many teams in the top 10 that cannot say they don't have a FCS team. And certainly Indiana is in that sweet spot again this year as they host the Howard Bison, certainly an FCS program and one that has frankly struggled a good bit this decade.
Yeah, I think it's, I think from the sort of, I don't know, facts and fears of the AP poll in the past, like I think Texas was the first number one team preseason to like drop, finish outside the top 10 since maybe 2011 or 2012. And I think on average over the last 10, 15 years, two teams who have finished or started in the top 10 have finished unranked. And last year, I think was maybe the first time that that hadn't, that, well, two teams did it last year with Clemson and Penn State. They're both top five to begin with. So yeah, there's going to be a trapdoor for somebody. I know we have a question about who it's going to be, but that, yeah. And it was funny thinking back to like Marcus Freeman's first game when they were ranked fifth in the preseason with that team. And now they're ranked fourth with this team. And you're like, wait a minute, there's only a spot difference in the preseason between the 2022 team and the 2026 team. Because the 2022 team felt like it should have been ranked 25th to start the season, not fifth. But so, yeah, it's like the preseason polls. I know there's discourse about how serious they should be and should we get rid of them. And I think it's kind of like an arcane, you know, look at college football over the years, but like it's for entertainment value. So I don't really have a huge problem with it.
I'm voting this year. Might have said this on the podcast. I hope I'm not repeating myself in the Football Writers Association poll. And when I agreed to it, I was just blanked on it. I was thinking it's top 25. Thank God it's top 16. It's the power poll, the super 16. So because 16 to 25, as the season goes on, that's when Sunday morning becomes an exercise in futility, trying to figure out September 21st, who I should move down from 23 to 21. So the super 16 kind of makes you feel like they're at least, those are the playoff contenders. All right, guys, before we go to break though, question from BWAC29. Pete kind of started it out. Every year an AP top 10, he said every year, AP top 10 team finishes the season unranked. Who is your prediction for this year? This is tough. I actually like the top 10. I would have had this top 10, not in the same order, but those 10 teams.
I am pretty skeptical about Oklahoma, and I realize that's like kind of cheating because they're 10th, but would not shock me if Oklahoma tumbled all the way out by the time the season ends.
I was debating that one as well, Pete. I think I'm going to go Texas A&M, though. I think they'll be outside of the top 10. Maybe Marcel Reed takes that giant step, but his numbers against Notre Dame, he threw for 340 yards or whatever it was, but he didn't complete 50% of his passes. He had some terrible performances against a number of SEC defenses, and they have an early season test on the road at Arizona State. They get LSU at home, Alabama at home, South Carolina at home. They have to go to Tennessee, home against Oklahoma, and then close the season at Texas. So Texas A&M is my pick, but honestly, I focused in on those three teams at 8, 9, and 10 and felt like I could have picked any one of the three because I think Ole Miss, they're fully invested in hating Lane Kiffin right now, but there will come a point this fall that Ole Miss misses Lane Kiffin.
I'm so much in agreement with 8, 9, and 10. I'm sure you guys read David Hale did a great piece with tiers of college football, and he had Notre Dame in tier one. And I would actually, the top seven teams, I think, are tier one this year. I think the top seven in the poll, so ending there with IU and Miami, are true tier one, and then any of those other three. I'm picking Oklahoma too, Pete, largely because a good way to stay out of a poll is to get knocked out early, and they have to play at Michigan, at Georgia, and against Texas. Then when they recover and win some games, they finish with Ole Miss, Texas A&M, and even at Missouri. So if you want to get in and out of a poll quickly, I think that that is one way to do it. You're just out of sight, out of mind. You crawl back in, and someone smacks you back. So Oklahoma's the pick. John Mateer. Pete and I have the John Mateer. We don't understand what people see in him wagon going to.
I don't get it.
I don't either. We will get to stuff in segment two, burning up the boards. We are back with segment two, burning up the boards. Our first question is a three-parter about the wide receivers. By the way, there is a wonderful stat on our message board, Pete Sampson and John Bryce, about why you don't need wide receivers. I think you should look it up soon because it's pretty remarkable, actually. No, it's actually a really good stat, but it does list a bunch of first-round draft picks along with it. Okay, Terry Bennett exists. Who is going to be the receiver of the week next week? Which is, if you guys were following along, it was probably Matt Jeffrey week one and Bubba Frazier week two. Meter Reader says, I don't get good vibes on the Quincy Porter situation. Mike Brown seemed like he was being held hostage and trying to use keywords when he was asked about him. What's up there? And JackMac99 says, why do I still feel conflicted about wide receivers? Pete, you were there for Mike Brown. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he's very cryptic in his answers about Quincy Porter. It's funny. The way this phrase is like, blink if you're okay, Mike.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking when he was.
Yeah, it was not good. And I mean, it's one of those things where like, it was to the point where he was kind of hedging and hemming and hawing. You're just like, this makes me not feel good about any of the guys, including the guys you should feel good about. So yeah, I don't feel great about the receivers. I think Jordan Faison is going to be really good, and he will be the first Notre Dame receiver to finish a regular season with 50 receptions.
Well, there we go.
Under Marcus Freeman. He almost got there last year. There's only two other schools in the Power Four that have not had a wide receiver finish with 50 catches in the last 4 years.
Is Claypool the last one? Because Austin.
Claypool is the last one. Okay. Wow. It's Iowa and Virginia Tech. So that's not a great place to be. I come out of this camp thinking the receiver position is deeper than it was last year, but I don't know if it's better at the top. And I kind of hope that it was going to be better at the top, and I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that there's a Malachi Fields there at the top of the receiver room or whomever like that. And Faison, as much as he's added muscle and dialed in on football and done all these things great, still has to prove that he can make it through a season relatively unscathed. Like if Notre Dame has a 16 game season, they've got to have Faison for 14 of those. And can he do that? So I completely get it. I think the Porter situation continues to be an enigma for the Irish, and that's frustrating. It's the top three that we know that are Mylon Graham and Faison and Greathouse, not in that order, just naming those three. And I think three of the next, that's where you have prospects. Those top three are the prospects. This is where I get to use my suspects line. So the next three suspects are Matt Jeffrey. I do continue to hear really good things about him. Can Micah Gilbert go from suspect to prospect and show some consistency? I think that's a concern. They are very pleased with the continued progress and the flashes of Bubba Frazier, and Fitzgerald has picked it up the last 10 days, I'm told, and really started making some strides. So that first three is really, I think, pretty entrenched at this point. There's a massive amount of jockeying to be in the next three for Notre Dame.
I'm pretty high on Greathouse, just the way he's carrying himself now. I kind of think he'll emerge as the second option for CJ Carr, with Mylon Graham, of course, being an extremely talented third option, or 2B. To double A, however you want to look at it. But, and I think Gilbert, I mean, I think Gilbert's in the rotation of the four man rotation, but it is by default. Somebody asked that on the board. He doesn't really have, Porter was the real competition there. I don't think anyone thought Cam Williams would beat out Micah Gilbert at the boundary, and Cam has been playing a little bit of X. Only heard good things about Matt Jeffrey. We did get Mike Brown question about Matt Jeffrey, and he was extremely positive on him. The problem is people keep thinking like Matt Jeffrey has to lead them in something. No, it's not that situation, but Matt Jeffrey can be your fifth and your sixth guy. And we all want to see Bubba Frazier next, right, Pete? Because he does have something, the quickness, the speed. It's just that he plays a slot and there's like four guys that can play it.
Yeah, I don't. It's until a freshman receiver does something, I'm not going to. I get it. Like, I like Devin Fitzgerald too, yep, in 2027. I just don't. How many preseasons have we covered where some freshman receiver does something? We're like, oh, hey. And then the season starts, and you're like, what happened to that guy? Do we ever hear from him again? What happened to Kevin Stefferson? Like, it's not – that's the last one. That guy did something in camp, and, like, then the season happened, and he did something. And that team went 4-8. Yeah. So, I think Bubba Frazier is intriguing. I mean, I don't – the clip that Notre Dame put out of the, you know, 50-yard touchdown they had where essentially he was untouched. I think that says more about CJ Carr leading him into green space than anything Bubba Frazier did or didn't do. But if you can run away from the starting defense untouched, like, that's not nothing. The fact that they gave you reps against the starting defense is not nothing.
It's true.
So that stuff matters, but man, they need something else at the top of the depth chart. And it's like when I talked to Mike Brown, and one of the questions I asked was like, so can you just play without a boundary receiver?
Yeah, I've been thinking that all offseason, if Jake Greathouse could be your boundary receiver. And I asked Greathouse, and, you know, he didn't commit to any answers in that interview, but he said he could play anything. I don't know what that means, if he would have said it anyway. But I would find it interesting. I feel like in modern college football, you don't have to have true boundary receiver at all times to pull it off. I'll say a positive I would add to the Notre Dame receiving core is after those three, you do have more guys. Like, we didn't mention Elijah Burris when we said Frazier, you do have more guys going for 5, 6, 7, 8 than you used to have. Like,
yeah, I mean, you used to have vacant roster spots.
Right. So you have guys that if they can get to the six, that might, by the way, Mike Brown did say it's probably going to start at 6 and could be 7 for game plans. That's their number you're looking for. And that'll be interesting and it can change a little bit. It's like, maybe Bubba Frazier is the October call up. That's also a thing that could help Notre Dame if you get one of those guys in October. Next question, CMU Penns fan. ND struggled in short yardage last year at times. How would you propose fixing it?
I mean, I would keep Cooper Flanagan healthy. So my pet theory about this team is Cooper Flanagan is way more important to the functioning of this offense than people give him credit for. It is very hard, because we spend 365 days a year talking about Notre Dame football, to talk about guys who are underrated. Yeah. Essentially, we're...
Great call. Yeah.
It's impossible to be underrated or being slept on because people are feeling hours and hours of podcast content. And yet, I feel like Cooper Flanagan might be. So that's how I would propose fixing it, having Cooper Flanagan go in and just, like, knock somebody's head off. And I think that... Look, I like Eli Raridan a lot. I wouldn't consider him a tenacious blocker in short yardage.
Improved. He was just an improved blocker, was what it became.
Yeah. Cooper Flanagan is a jerk to play against, and I think he can give Notre Dame some real attitude in those situations.
Yeah, and we know that from the fact that even in spring and in other settings, when he's been healthy, he's been right there in the thick of it. Like, he plays with such an intensity that it gets under his teammates' skin on the practice field, so you know it can impact opponents that aren't used to seeing that or don't know that about him on a weekly basis. So I think Flanagan is definitely a key and keeping him healthy, but also he's got to do enough in the throw game to where every time you see him line up, you don't necessarily assume he's only blocking. And that's where you have to continue to build out your depth there. And whether that's Larson, who I think has made some strides in this camp, or the continued development and the expectation that eventually sometime this year, Ian Primmer will play. Flanagan's a huge part of it. Keeping the offensive line, the line that you start with at Wisconsin, keeping it relatively intact, I think also is huge. I do believe Anthony Knapp is going to make a tremendous impact for Notre Dame at that guard position and help Notre Dame specifically be better in short yardage by kicking inside and just giving Notre Dame that tenacity that he plays with, that rugged physicality. And then also Notre Dame's going to be a little bit larger overall on the offensive line because of that. So I think those are elements that all should help Notre Dame be better in short yardage.
JB, before we move on to the next question, I want to, Pete, you and I have said for years, you like having a guy like Cooper Flanagan in the line and a low center of gravity running back. But I also love it when they spread out and do that. Notre Dame can bully 8 to 9 teams. You can't bully everyone throughout the college football playoffs. So I'm actually going to ask Mike Denbrock the utility of more of a spread formation and it's one man beating one man. I'd love to hear an offensive coordinator say it instead of just you and I on a podcast saying, why don't they spread out more and hand the ball off? Because I sometimes get so congested, I just give today's front seven athletes the advantage when it's all straight downhill and all you're doing is attacking downhill.
Question number 3 from Otzerpool. What are some of the best debuts by new starting Notre Dame running backs, and will Aeneas Williams have a chance to throw his name in the mix against Wisconsin. And Tio, before I turn it over to you, I have to correct myself. So I got the Indiana schedule thing a little jumbled up. They are number 33 in ESPN FPI. They are ahead of Notre Dame in that ranking. There's another one I saw this week that had Indiana ranked behind Notre Dame in terms of strength of schedule. I don't remember which one it was, but anyway, so there you go. What is the best starting debuts that you've seen by Notre Dame running backs, and can Aeneas enter into that conversation against Wisconsin?
Yeah, the Wisconsin part, I think the thing Wisconsin does well is stop the run. So I think maybe C.J. Carr might enter the what's the best game by a second-year starting quarterback in the opener. C.J. Carr might have that game against Wisconsin instead of Aeneas. But, Pete, the first thing that came to mind is a funny one because it was his starting debut as a senior.
Yes.
Starting debut senior game four? Or no, can't be game four. Game five. And it was Dexter Williams getting a handoff against Stanford, taking it 45 yards to open his starting life. And I think he ran for about $1.60 in that game. And I want to steal one more from Pete because he was covering the team then. And I lived in Atlanta. Notre Dame ran for 15 yards against BYU in the 2004
opener.
Sorry. All right, go ahead. You can go ahead then.
Yeah, I mean, Darius Walker went from DNP at BYU when I think Travis Thomas had 6 carries for 2 yards in that game. A week later at home against top 10 Michigan, Darius Walker, freshman, had 31 carries for $1.15 and 2 touchdowns. I think they're both in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
And Notre Dame won. So that's the best. I don't think it's possible for Aeneas Williams to do better than that based on the fact it was top 10 Michigan.
It's top 10 Michigan after the worst rushing performance in who knows how long to open a season.
Weeks.
Yeah, weeks. But so I guess Darius, the joke, of course, was Darius just wasn't ready, right? 7 days prior to
BYU
after he went through Michigan. Some other ones people are probably remembering. CJ Procise had to take over for Tarion Fulston. And out there at Virginia, he ran for $1.55. Kyren Williams, actually, 2020 against Duke. Not only did he have, I think, 100 yards and 2 scores, he had a 75-yarder reception called back, Pete. Remember? That would have been a huge game for Kyren Williams. And then I went way back machine because I remember being watching this one. Reggie Brooks against Northwestern. Senior year starting debut. 9 carries. 157 yards on his 9 carries. So that was a good day. But that Northwestern is not the one that came around a couple years later. So I think the Darius Walker is the way to go. From Maltese Irish, can you remember any season in your time covering the team in which a schedule perceived to be soft wound up being way stronger than initially projected? Pete, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I spent some time thinking of those. Honestly, I'm not sure I really could come up with one. I mean, there are some years where, you know, like going back to 2002, when they signed the deal to open with Maryland that year, I was like, well, Maryland stinks. And like the year before they won 10 games. They're like, wait a minute. So that does happen sometimes. But I didn't think there's one because it goes in both directions. Like rarely, you know, one team is better than you thought. And then another team is a total dumpster fire that you weren't expecting. So I'm not sure I've got a great answer for Maltese Irish on this one.
JB, I'll jump in real fast. I wasn't covering the team, but I thought of the 95 season, Northwestern again. Northwestern was nobody, 28-point underdog, and went to the Rose Bowl. So that got a little bit harder as the season progressed. And like Ohio State was good, seen as good, like 12, 13, 14. I mean, they were insane that year with Orlando Pace winning the Lombardi Award. So you went from thinking, oh, Ohio State will be pretty good, to holy God, they're good. And then, of course, the Northwestern thing. In that year, they played. Notre Dame ended up playing teams ranked 14, 15, 12, 8, 6, and in the bowl game, 4. That's a season. I look back, and these are the number of ranked teams Notre Dame has faced in the last several years. So starting with 2025, 4, 4, 4, 4, 2 in 2021, 3, 4, 4, and then 2017, they faced 5. So it's not crazy as long as they face 3 in this one. The thing is, and I've said this on a couple of shows, is JB, they don't have any middle ground teams.
Yes.
Someone has to become a middle ground team on this schedule.
Yeah. And when you look at the tiers that many different sites have put out ranking these teams, and it's just luck of the draw. It's not like Notre Dame controls who it plays from the SEC, but it's got 4 of the worst teams from the ACC on its schedule this year. So I don't have one. I couldn't pick out a schedule, not that's relevant in this 12-team playoff era that I think you could compare to this Notre Dame schedule. Again, I don't think this Notre Dame schedule is as bad as others. You need, if you're Notre Dame this year, you need Michigan State to be ahead of the curve in its rebuild under Pat Fitz. You need this Wisconsin team to, and we've discussed this before on the pod, this Wisconsin team is going to have plenty of opportunities its final 11 games to help Notre Dame out, whether Luke Fickell wants to or not, by winning some games that he frankly needs to win anyway to keep his job there in Madison. So that's kind of how I assessed and looked at that question.
I mean, if you think about it, they don't play Indiana, Ohio State, Michigan, or Oregon, Wisconsin. So go beat Penn State, beat USC. That'd be kind of funny to help out Notre Dame, and go win at Iowa. You could have a decent Wisconsin team by the end of the year in terms of their record. They missed all the heavyweights. Next question from Backer Tiki. Got to draw some smiles. Would Notre Dame actually be putting itself at a competitive disadvantage if they allowed more media access at camp and practices? Because I assume that's the reason for the very limited August access.
I think that Marcus Freeman has a paranoia of this kind of in this realm. And I think we sort of view him as like this cool hip coach, but like for media access, he is not for practice. he's much more older school than that. So, you know, I guess there is a competitive disadvantage, although it didn't really seem to bother Pete Carroll at USC. So
you imagine covering all those open practices.
Oh God, it'd be the worst.
There's no middle ground, huh?
No time for podcasting at all.
I've talked about that with some other reporters and that element of having open practice. And we had that some years at Tennessee. I think Lane Kiffin did it early. Derek Dooley at times did it. Fulmer had started doing it and then closed stuff down pretty tight. But, you know, right now there's so many people credentialed covering many of these practices. There's a school of thought, maybe it's a selfish one from myself and other reporters, that, okay, make all the practices open for the first 2 weeks of camp. And by the end of the second week, compare your media attendance roster to day one of the first week. And you'll get an idea of who then moving forward should have practice access. And also, I think because of that, you know, Marcus Freeman trusts UTO and Pete immensely and a handful of other reporters, but there's too many reporters out there that Marcus Freeman doesn't know. And he's not alone in that. You know, I compare these stuff, the FWAA compares these access guidelines, and Notre Dame is fairly in line. It's frustrating. It makes it harder for all of us to do our jobs. I think, again, I'm pretty sure I heard Kyle Whittingham at Big Ten Media Days say, like, everyone's welcome at practice and to come out and watch practice. So at least Notre Dame is not making absurd headlines with saying you can come to practice, but you better not have your notebook out or be speaking into your phone or anything else, or you'll have your credential revoked, like has been the case out at Colorado. But that's a whole different element altogether.
I am advocating for still that I don't think it would be much of a disadvantage at all, even if you're paranoid about it, to see practice one and practice five when they're in pads. We did have that quite a bit in the past, and then I would shut it down too if I was a coach in August. I'd make spring more open because I don't think people will understand what's going on enough to break things down and to keep the cameras out after the 20 minutes of individual periods anyway. But I think one open practice would help. And I get last year even more so with the rough start with Miami, and the quarterback competition was something that, you know, you don't want people reporting on every minute of the day. But today, I mean, nowadays, what are you reporting on? You had a left guard or right guard competition and a field cornerback competition. I think that would probably go just fine.
Question number six from no one. I'm not sure. I think no one asks more questions than anyone. You have an opportunity to watch a full practice once camp ends. You can only report on one offensive player and one defensive player. Which player are you choosing and why? And oh, by the way, per the questioner, no duplicates. T.O.
Draft form. All right. I am looking at, because once I am getting into game week, it's none of this who's your third running back and fourth running back junk anymore. So I want to watch Mylon Graham on offense and see if he's as good as we thought he was in the spring, where he is, how he's performing out there. Cause I'm really intrigued by the Pete Sampson, Tim O'Malley, and I believe multiple people notion of you don't need a boundary receiver if you have three other good receivers.
I'm going to draft somebody on defense then and get the first pick on that side of the ball.
I was going to suggest that, actually.
Okay. I would watch KVA. I want to see how healthy he actually is and how they're using him. because I do think he is like kind of this freaky force multiplier for a defense that should have a great, great defensive line and maybe an even better secondary. So if you have Kingston Viliamasu sort of, not saying he doesn't have like gap responsibilities, but man, I think you could get incredibly aggressive with him. So that would be who I would want to watch. He's my number one pick.
I'm going to go last, but go ahead and give your offensive pick, Pete, and then give your defensive pick, T.O.
Okay, all right. It's an odd draft we have going here. It's not really snake or standard, but we'll go ahead, Pete. You got that.
offensively, the questions, I make the rules.
Yeah, I would have taken Mylon Graham.
Great minds.
So, I mean, I guess this is an obvious one. I'm going to take Carr because I want to see how he drives the bus in a different way than last year. And I think even you're seeing the very limited clips come out from practice where it's, you know, the Bubba Frazier touchdown where Carr lets Frazier gets inside of Gray. Carr lets him run through Boubacar Traore's drop into zone coverage and hits him for an untouched 50-yard touchdown, or that ball to backup tight end Jack Larson the other day where he's dropping it in a bucket in front of Leonard Moore and beyond Bronte Johnson. Like, those are big-time throws. So I think Carr is always kind of a fun watch in practice anyway, but like a game-week Carr in practice would be even better.
My defensive guy, you mentioned him, in coverage is Christian Gray. I think Christian Gray's underrated. Not nationally, he's overrated nationally. They have him like the top 20 in the country, but he's underrated by Notre Dame fans. Just the nickel thing is – that is a whole wait and see thing for me. It's just a different spot. He's got the skills to do it, but it also by seeing him, I got to see him go against some of Notre Dame's best receivers when you have Greathouse, Graham, and Faison moving to that slot.
My draft rules were created with great whimsy. How dare you question them? Through serendipity, neither of you with your four answers, again, I'm selfless like that. Neither of you with your four answers took either of my answers. Offense. Who do we talk the most about? We talk the most about Quincy Porter, the great enigma. Nobody knows what's going on. So that's who I'm picking once the season starts to get
going inside to watch something different.
Yeah. What are you going to actually see?
That's part of it.
Yes, it is.
Okay. See a little, see a lot. See a lot, you don't see anything. And then defensively, I'm completely cheating, just rolling the dice like Viva Las Vegas. And I'm picking Chris Ash. Because Notre Dame is a playoff team last year. If Chris Ash is better to start the season. So now I want to see Chris Ash interacting with these players early in the season. I want to see Chris Ash interacting with these coaches earlier in the season. So I know no one's question said pick a player, but I told you last night, T.O., I knew exactly where I was going with my defensive answer to this question. Quincy was a late ad because I deferred to you gentlemen out of magnanimity, but it's Chris Ash. It's Chris Ash all day. I'm taking Chris Ash.
Got a thesaurus out today.
And, yeah. No, I just speak like that all the time.
This is like, you ever see the Friends when Joey Lawrence started using a thesaurus to try to say, to do a job resume, and all the words were just as wild as you could get. Yes. That's what JB is doing right here on this podcast.
Not at all.
That's good times. Our next question from I Told Althea, or it could be One Told Althea. I'm not sure how I typed that. A big part of Marcus Freeman teams have been the havoc plays. Who will be the players who cause havoc beyond the obvious? Obvious might be like KVA. What non-starter will cause a disproportionate amount of havoc defensively? Let's say Leonard Moore and KVA are obvious.
Yeah, I think this goes back to it's hard to be underrated. There's a lot of obvious players here. Jalen Snead, I think he's still kind of a wild card type player. I'm not sure if he's an every down linebacker, but I think he could be a third down pass rushing type of linebacker, and that lends itself to a lot of havoc types of plays. So I'll go Jalen Snead here.
I tried to not think about just the normal grouping of players to answer this question and who we all think will be some of those havoc plays. This is where I think the 5-for-5 and Notre Dame's advanced recruiting under Marcus Freeman come into play. So maybe it's a Joy O'Brien or a Kari Adams or one of those guys. But I think somebody, one of the newcomers, is responsible for some havoc plays this season. I mean, it would be easy to pick a Boubacar Traore or to go the route that Pete talked about, but that's where I'm going. Like, I think per snap, those guys are going to be impact players. Kind of like we saw Bronte Johnson do last year. Like, he started making plays on a per snap basis that even though he had had that great preseason camp that we all talked about, he still was performing at such a level of efficiency. So I think there will be some newcomers, especially empowered by the 5-for-5 to have more of those young guys on some of the core four special teams, and then also maybe being able to incorporate them into some additional packages.
All right, I am going to use the non-starter technically because he's going to play a lot, but non-starter will be Luke Talic because he does wreak a lot of havoc, special teams and defense. And I'll go way off the box here for special teams. You guys talked about, you know, who's going to create some havoc this year? And I think Jaden Greathouse and Marty Biagi both kind of gave it away. He always does when they use him, special teams and otherwise, Jordan Faison. Jordan Faison blocking punts, returning. Jordan Faison is going to play a lot of special teams this year. And I know he's not going to have as many havoc plays as Bronte Johnson and Adon Shuler and these guys. But I'm saying, going outside the box, Luke Talic is my reserve, and Jordan Faison will be the special teams player of the year if he stays healthy. I think they can, he can really.
Interesting.
I think they can, yeah, I think they can be effective more in the punt block. And I think in his own way, Jasper Scaife will have some havoc moments as well. Like I'm very intrigued by him. I just keep having too many people in the program telling me like the dude's actually an athlete.
Did you hear our podcast? We were talking, not our podcast. It was a podcast after the first practice where we heard him punting. Oh my God. Pete, we're all standing around the bleachers. Like the rest of the team was eating refreshments and eating fruit and drinking water. And all of a sudden, the loudest noise you've heard is this guy punting. And all of us look up like, what the hell was that? He was on.
Yeah, it was. It was like the special teams version of Kevin Austin from 2020 in spring.
Bombs. Just absolute bombs. I think Drew Mentok said his worst punt went 54 with hang time.
Yeah. If John was a little bit more generous with the question about who you'd watch in a full practice and included specialists, I would have put Jasper Scaife as my number one pick there, but John didn't let us do that.
Well, blame no one for a too narrow question, and then blame O'Malley for not having the foresight as the architect of this. Instead of being an artful dodger, he could have expanded the question.
Like the thesaurus just came back out. Next question, VA Doc. Does the typical elite football recruit sign grant and aid agreement, a revenue-sharing contract, and a NIL contract with Notre Dame? JB, you want to take that part first, or do you want to hold the whole question? Can you briefly summarize the difference between a revenue share contract and an NIL contract?
Yeah, so an elite football recruit or player that Notre Dame is devoting one of its 105 scholarships to is going to still sign a grant and aid agreement, and also I think full cost of attendance agreement. Those are separate completely from rev share and NIL. Rev share then is the direct payment for a player from the school. NIL is more of the third party agreement where maybe you have an NIL agreement with Under Armour, like Joey O'Brien did before he ever stepped foot on the Notre Dame campus. And then maybe like if you're a Will Black, more of your income is derived from the direct rev share. So Notre Dame has the ability to dispense its rev share. Again, the number for this football season is $21.35 million. And the official rev share distribution per the House settlement on Notre Dame football is eating up the overwhelming majority of that. I mean, a tremendous percentage of that. But I'm learning and working on a story next week for USA Today that like foreign-born players such as Will Black, their payments have to be structured a little bit differently so as not to disrupt their status here on a student visa. So that's been something that you don't think about, but you have to learn about because right now they're not considered employees. And by not being employees and being on a student visa, there are some constraints there with how much they're actually legally allowed to earn, where they have to go earn it. Does the money then have to be sent back to Canada or how is it distributed? But the rev share agreement is direct from the school. NIL agreements are more third party. That's the easiest way to summarize that.
I think another way to look at it is like, I don't know if you've seen like CJ Carr's NIL stuff. I think he had something with Motorola, but also like he had a commercial with Eater with Marcus Freeman in New York where they're, you know, having chocolate covered strawberries at some swanky restaurant or something and talking about their favorite food. So that's all above the rev share. So I think it's important to know that if you see a player in a commercial, that is above the rev share. And that includes like if you see Spencer Porath in a Drive and Shine commercial, which I have, that's above whatever his rev share is. But these like occasionally you get like these marketing emails from Notre Dame about like autograph signings. That my understanding, that's like, that's the, that is rev share. That is that's rev, like yeah. university yeah. function type stuff.
So let's say like a player is getting $500,000 as a freshman to come to Notre Dame. So then the money breaks down. Notre Dame determines the player and presumably his representative, whether it's a parent, guardian, or an actual agent. They really, as it's explained to me, only care about the bottom line number. Okay, I'm getting $500,000. That's great. They don't care that $200,000 comes from Notre Dame's rev share and the other $300,000 comes from NIL deals that Notre Dame helps broker or the individual institution helps broker. They focus on the bottom line number and then the money is doled out from separate streams. So revenue rev share is one component. And some guys, again, have to have a large portion of rev share, especially if they're younger and don't have the true NIL opportunities. The older guys can get their number with more legitimate NIL opportunities and take up less of the rev share.
All I heard there was Spencer Porath and that John Sott missed out on some incredible opportunities here, Pete Sampson, by punting.
The long snapper was in it, too. He was, like, long snapping a towel and hit Spencer Porath in the head. And then I think, I don't know, I was like, you know, hey, you do you, guys. Good on you for finding an NIL deal.
Do I have to go to Drive and Shine to see this, or could I look it up possibly on the internet? Is this like
I think the internet will I don't think Spencer Porath just hangs out at Drive and Shine and kick towels at your car.
Remember Jack Cohn had his picture like about as big as what you're looking at on our screen right now with the four of us with
at a Core Life Eatery.
Core Life Eatery, yes, that was 2021. Good for him. Probably a little bit more now. Final question from Siggy 12. He says the following traits are hallmarks of great teams with a yes or no answer. Respond to the following questions. Will ND be able to, number one, I will go to Pete Sampson first, get consistent pressure with four rushers?
Yes, mercifully so. Marcus Freeman talked about that so much last year, and I feel like they never did it. This team's going to do it.
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with Pete. I'm going with a pretty hard yes there.
Concur, especially when it's you get to the packages. Number two, stay ahead of the chains running against a good defensive line. So in other words, let's eliminate about eight of them.
No, that's hard to do.
So, I mean, ahead of the chains, are you talking about consistently second and seven, second and eight, or are you ahead of the chains as long as you're not second and 13 because you're consistently getting stuff? I think they're going to be pretty consistent running the football and setting the tone and frankly, deferring to people who have been to a number of practices who are very encouraged by what Notre Dame is doing against an incredibly tough defense it's facing day after day by being able to run fairly effectively enough to not find itself in consistent second and 12 situations.
I think rush efficiency could be good this year for yes. When you get a good defensive line, like Pete said, and this is not a yes or no all of a sudden, breaking some rules. I don't think anyone does a very good job of staying consistently ahead of the game against a good defensive
Real hard to do.
Really hard to do. But for most of the schedule, yes. Number three, and it's timely, have a reliable third down playmaker offensively.
Yes, Jordan Faison.
I'm actually saying yes, but I'm going with CJ Carr. Like, I trust him to make good decisions. So he's going to be your best third down playmaker because he's going to be able to read the defenses, determine what's needed, and then execute the play.
And I would throw in Aeneas Williams as a reliable third down playmaker. All right, final one, and this is important because they lost it from last year. Generate explosive plays on offense. Last year they had Love, Price, Malachi Fields.
I feel like no. Unless it's Carr. Because like the thing with Carr is stuff is open for him that is not open for most quarterbacks, even though the route and the concepts are all the same and the defense is the same. Carr is able to make throws other quarterbacks can't. Carr is able to see things other quarterbacks don't see. So maybe they will be explosive on offense, but it's not going to be the like incredible physical skills of Jeremiah Love that's doing it, where like he can get hit in the backfield and still run for 57 yards. I think Carr's ability to layer throws is elite. So Maybe they will be explosive on offense, but I think it's just going to be a lot different. It's kind of a lot less to do with who's catching it than who's throwing it.
Yeah,
I don't. That was not yes or no, and I apologize to Siggy 12.
I know. Well, O'Malley does a poor job framing these questions. It's not Siggy's fault. I don't think they're going to be the home run team that we saw last year at any given moment from Jeremiah Love, Jadarian Price, or even if Malachi Fields or somebody stretched behind the defense. But I think they're going to be a much better team at getting large chunks of yardage, 20 to 30 yard plays, because of CJ Carr in the throw game. So that's kind of how I answer that one, which is also not a yes or no answer, but we like to provide some nuance.
No-ish. No, I think they'll be efficient offensively. I don't think you'll call them an explosive offensive team. They just had differentiators last year. It's hard to have, but I think it'll be very efficient because of the quarterback and the running back, Aeneas Williams. We've been pretty efficient too, although that second segment might have gone long, but that's a pretty efficient podcast, guys. Thank you for joining. Pete Sampson, I will see you tomorrow at Notre Dame mid-afternoon. Marcus Freeman is going to host press conference wrapping up fall camp. JB, we've been joking. I don't know if I said this to you or not, that this might be right before the big scrimmage Saturday, so he doesn't have to tell us anything. And all he has to say the entire time is, well, we have a big scrimmage tomorrow to decide these positions. That could be happening as well. But we do know that the training camp portion will end this weekend, and they will move into game prep, which means some guys are going to scout team. Anything to add there, JB? Because I think that's what's going to happen, right? On that, he's going to be able to defer to the Saturday scrimmage.
That's the certain speculation I've received this morning.
It's a genius move. Regardless, we'll be back on Monday, August 24th. Until then, for John Bryce of USA Today, Pete Sampson of The Athletic, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider.